Love what you do. Work with people who know more than you do. Do the right thing always. If you make mistakes, own them. We all make mistakes, but own them because other people might help you solve them a little bit better.
That's Emma Swain, the CEO of St. Supery, an estate vineyard and winery in California's Napa Valley, espousing advice for aspiring CEOs. I'm Neil Amato, a senior editor with FM Magazine. And on this episode of the FM podcast, Swain doles out knowledge on a host of topics, on keeping ego in check, why St. Supery is big on sustainability efforts, and how she strategically uses her phone's Do Not Disturb button. Here's the episode with Emma Swain. Emma, thank you for being on the podcast.
Neil, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be with you today.
So in a previous conversation, you said to me, some people think I work too much. What's your response maybe to that, or maybe how has that changed over the years?
Well, I think you've probably been talking to my husband. I probably do work too much, but I really love my job. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy the people that I work with, and I enjoy the challenge. And so I think that, you know, on the opposite hand, I'm really blessed to work in an industry that I'm passionate about, with people I enjoy working with, and doing something great every day that I'm able to combine science, hospitality, and business all in one.
You studied agriculture and managerial economics at the University of California, Davis. It sounds to me like the perfect mix to become CEO of an estate winery in Napa. Tell me something about that.
Well, it is a lot of fun going to university where viticulture and enology are two of the most important majors. Of course, we don't want to offend the medical students and the vet students and everything, but I think they are two of the most important majors at the university. So I also was doing a minor in biology, and so I spent a lot of time in the food science courses and biochemistry and that sort of thing, which adding with the agricultural and managerial economics is really perfect for the wine business because we're a business, we're an art form, and we're a science.
So tell me some about also the accounting journey. You came out of that degree, but then I believe you worked at a public accounting firm first?
I did. I started in public accounting working for Arthur Andersen in the Bay Area here in California. And my first day, we were all sent to school for 6 weeks to get the requisite number of accounting classes because I didn't have enough pure accounting courses. So we spent 6 weeks learning a lot about accounting and getting ready to sit for that CPA exam. But I worked on the tax side. Of course, I did the requisite amount of audit, but it was very enjoyable. And I worked in a smaller office during the last part of my tenure there. And that office was a test subject for the whole country at the time. And the purpose of the new office was to be a little bit more flexible than the larger firms were known for at that point in time. And we focused on small emerging businesses and family-owned businesses. And so that's how I really got involved with the small business side and family-owned business side. Because here in Napa Valley, 95% of the wineries are family-owned, and it's a very much a family-owned and operated industry. And with that, you have transitions that happen with companies and a lot of sort of unique family enterprise situations. So that was one of kind of the great experiences for me, was working with a lot of diverse industries, businesses, and agriculture. And through that part of the organization, I was leased out as a controller to the Coppola family at their winery starting in the early 90s. And I got very involved in the wine business there and truly fell in love with it. It had always been my husband's and my goal to be able to move to Napa Valley after college, and this was a great opportunity. So while working for the Coppolas, I was able to assist them in purchasing the Inglenook property, which is a significant estate here in Napa Valley and a really fun acquisition. It took quite a bit of time, but it was a great learning experience for me. And then from there, I went to work for a significantly larger winery, the Sebastiani Vineyards, and at that time we were sort of second or third largest winery in the country and making about 8 million cases. And it was a very different business program than this small boutique winery that the Coppolas owned in Napa Valley, a true business, and I was the CFO there, and we sold that company to Constellation Brands. So that was my first selling of a company. And we went from 8 million cases to 70,000 cases, and I became the chief operating officer, and we rebuilt the Sebastiani brand, and we grew it, and we sold it again. So there's not a lot of transactions that were happening in the wine industry at that time, there's compared to other industries, and so that experience has been very helpful for me and was one of the reasons that I came over to St. Supery with a family-operated business looking to transition in the next few years when I started.
So yeah, so you've been at St. Supery, I believe, as the CEO since 2009, so 10 years, is that correct?
Yes, 10 years.
So why do you think you're a good match for St. Supery?
Well, I think that experience in acquisitions and dispositions of companies was helpful to me coming in 2009. And I've always been a little bit of a turnaround person. And coming in 2009, that was an important skill to have with the economy and the state that it was. Both of those helped. Plus, I was very involved in marketing and sales as the chief operating officer at Sebastiani Vineyards. So that experience helped me be prepared to handle the whole thing in kind of a challenging time in the industry and in the country. And then, of course, we sold the company in 2015 to Chanel.
Oh, okay. So that's a change since I guess we talked, and I'll go ahead and bring it up since it is our audience of magazine readers that
we had featured you, I guess, in a 2013, I believe, Journal of Accountancy Q&A. So that's changed since then, that the winery has been sold.
Yeah. So that's been, you know, great for everyone involved, and it was, you know, a wonderful process. And we've been investing a lot of time and energy back in the winery and making great wines.
On the work front and the technology front, has technology over the years changed enough to maybe not have you working so much at your desk?
Well, I don't spend a lot of time at my desk because I do travel a fair amount, and I enjoy that travel, but I do spend the same amount of time on my computer. It just may be in another part of the world or at my desk at home or, you know, on the airplane.
Yeah, so we'll get back to a little bit more on the travel topic in a little bit. But staying on maybe technology, but also something else that's changed a little bit since we last spoke. Social media, the importance for brands to be active on social media. It was important to you then. I'm sure it's important now. Can you see kind of the true business reasons to have, for example, an Instagram account?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for us, we're not just a business. We're in the hospitality business. We engage with our customers. We want to stay in touch with our customers. I mean, just like you want to stay in touch with your friends, we want to stay in touch with our guests here at the winery, the people we meet around the country. We have a social media campaign in the fall called Share the Joy. Because what we do is we share wine with friends and family, and we share joy with each other. And in each bottle is a bottle of what we think is joy. And our current campaign is called What Brings You Joy, because it could be the sunrise on your way to work in the morning. It could be sharing a bottle of wine with friends, kicking back, cooking. All of these things bring us joy, and I think that's an important thing to celebrate in life. And when celebrating it, sharing a photo on Instagram is a natural way to do so, to share with your friends what makes you happy. And we're often pleased to be part of that happiness.
Shifting gears a little bit, because I could come back to joy. We could talk plenty about joy, the joy of wine, I'm sure.
The joy of being outside, the joy of being with friends, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Has technology changed how grapes are grown or monitored or how wine is bottled? I mean, is that something that remains a really, you know, I don't know, static thing?
Oh, goodness, no, it's not static at all. You know, first of all, we're farmers, but we're also scientists. And that's critical to growing fine wine. And we're an estate winery, so that means that we grow all of our own grapes in the same vineyards every year. We make them at the same winery every year in the same appellation. We have complete control over that process. So looking at the vineyard every year and monitoring the health of the soil, the plants, the amount of water that we're receiving. We have multiple weather stations around the property. We have soil probes. We've got drones to see what the canopy growth is in the vineyard. So there's a tremendous amount of technology and science that we use in tracking and testing throughout the year. I mean, when we plant a cover crop in the vineyard, we're looking at what does the soil need and what are we going to plant that's going to add that back to the soil. What does the vine need? So there's a tremendous amount of science, and then there's a tremendous amount of hard work. My colleagues in the vineyard are out there touching every vine by hand 20 to 25 times during the growing season. There's this huge amount of manual labor that goes into it, but there's also a science as to how they're pruning it, what they're doing, and the testing that we're doing as we go along that's essential. I mean, when we are testing in the summertime, you know, we'll have a heat wave. We'll do pressure bombs on the leaves to see how much water is in the vine and do we need to irrigate, do we not need to irrigate, because we want to have the best quality product. And to do that, we need to use deficit irrigation, but we also need to take into account the health of the vine.
So, yeah, it definitely sounds like science and technology are a big part. There's still that personal observation. I mean, you talked about the people actually out there touching the vines, but it seems like it's mixing with the things such as drones. I mean, do you recall how many years you've had drones in place for monitoring?
So we just started using the drones this year. We used small aircraft previously to fly over, and we've been doing that for years and tracking and comparing the vineyards over the season and over the years. So that's just, you know, the vineyard component. In the winery, there's a tremendous amount of technology that we use here. We implemented optical sorting in the winery. In 2012, we started doing that, and it's amazing. It's the coolest thing. So we have, it's just like our hand sorting system, but it's very fast. And what we do is we select 200 perfect berries, and we put them on the optical sorter, and there's a robotic eye that takes 1,000 photos per second, and we run it through in test mode, and we take a picture of all of those berries and say, this is what we're looking for, this is perfect, and then we run the berries through, and the eye takes the picture, and in a 10-centimeter space, it decides if it matches those 200 berries that we first selected for color, shape, size. And if it doesn't, it kicks it out with a little air knife, and off it goes. So it's really amazing in enabling us to have just this beautiful fruit. When we pick by hand, we pick it about a ton to a ton and a half an hour when we're sorting those grapes. And it takes 14 people. The optical sorter, we run it at about 6 tons an hour, and it takes 4 people.
Wow. That does sound amazing. I want to get one clarification. You used that word, a two-syllable word that I wouldn't have thought you've used. Berries?
Berries, yeah. The grapes, yeah. We refer to them as berries.
I had not heard them referred to as that.
The fruit, berries.
I read a report about a year and a half ago about global wine production in some areas of France and also South Africa. You know, climate change had affected the overall output of those countries' crops. Tied into that, I guess, is sustainability, which is a word that's bandied about, I guess, plenty in business. What does that word sustainability mean for you and St. Supery?
Oh, well, sustainability is kind of ingrained in everything we do. As I mentioned, we're an estate winery, so we control everything in our process. And we have a significant vineyard in the northeastern corner of Napa Valley. It's a little over 1,530 acres. About a third of that property is planted to vineyard, and the rest is mostly left in its natural state. But sustainability to us is taking care of that entire property. It's not just the vineyard component. We take care of that entire property because it needs to be there for future generations. And it's like its own valley within Napa Valley. So we have to think about erosion from the hillside and is that going into our river and how we protect the property for future generations. And we use cover crops. We put hay on the hills. We use sheep to graze the grass down so that we aren't impacting the soil with more tractor passes. I mean, we have a tremendous amount of sustainable practices. I could go on and on in the vineyard, but we are certified Napa Green, which is the most stringent sustainable certification in the wine business in the world. And it requires us to comply with a massive binder of processes to ensure that we're sustainable. And then we get inspected by federal, state, and local organizations. And then we set goals to continue to improve what we're doing in the vineyard and for the land. And those goals have to be met when we get recertified every 5 years. So it's a very intense process, and it's wonderful for me to have someone else tell my team that we need to get better other than me just saying it all the time. So I think that's important. And so that's for us in the vineyard. We're doing everything we can to make sure this property is better than it was today, 50 years from now. So at the winery, we are also certified Napa Green, and that means different things at the winery. It also means that we're watching our power usage. So right now, about 80% of our power bill is covered by solar, and we're installing two more solar systems on the property, so we should be 100% by the end of the year. We recycle all of our water at the winery. At the ranch, we use all reclaimed rainwater for any of our irrigation needs and water usage at the ranch. We set goals every 3 years for sustainable certification here, and we have to meet or exceed those goals in order to get recertified. So that is super important to us. It's about how we compost, how we recycle, what type of light bulbs we use, how we take care of our people, how we take care of the environment, and how we take care of our natural resources. So it's not just what's happening in the vineyard. It's what we do every day, whether we're in the office and we are printing something or we're keeping everything in PDF with online filing.
Those are good points. Let me ask you some, you know, you mentioned these sustainability initiatives, the composting, the recycling of water, the solar installation. I think a lot of people are for sustainability, but then a lot of times in business, people say, well, am I going to make money off it? I know that's not the only thing, but do you foresee things like solar panels that you've had, I guess, for a couple of years, saving the winery money?
Absolutely. They save the winery money, but most of all, it's the right thing to do, right? And it's the beauty of working for a privately held company. We have a long-term view, and we're doing what's best today for the future. It's not about what the return is today. It's what's that long-term return for everyone. And that's what you have to think about. You can't just think, well, it's going to be this much more money. That's too much. It's like, you know, we have to think about, is it what's best for who we are? Is it what's best for our people? Those are overriding in our company culture and our core values.
We touched on travel earlier, as in you're not at your desk, you're working, but you're maybe traveling and working at the same time. You travel all over. How many weeks a year would you estimate, and what exactly are you traveling for?
So I probably travel about 20 weeks a year, maybe a little bit more. I cover all of our international markets. So when I travel internationally, I work with our importers and distributors in other markets for a sales plan. I meet with press and influencers in those markets, as well as collectors and restaurateurs, chefs, and I provide training about our wine, training about Napa Valley, and just engage with great food and wine pairings. When I travel in the U.S., I work with our distributor partners around the country to plan how our business is going to improve and exceed with our sales team. So in the wine business, we're required to sell through the three-tier system. And if we want to be in a restaurant or retail account, we have to sell to a distributor who then sells to the restaurant or retailer who then sells to the end consumer. We can sell direct to consumer from the winery in multiple locations and from our location in Beverly Hills. But for the most part, our wholesale business has to go through this three-tier system. So a lot of that is relationships and planning and incentive work with those distributors around the country.
And how is that sales model different? Does it differ by country if you're talking about international sales?
It does. For the most part, in most of the countries that I'm in, there's an importer who also distributes but may also sell to other distributors. In Canada, you're dealing with the government, so you're selling through the government, with the exception of Alberta. So there's a lot of different rules in every country, just like we have here in the U.S. by state.
Do you have a favorite place that you've gone internationally, a favorite country, one you look forward to going back to a lot?
I always love going to France. I always love going to Canada because the people are so darn nice. And Australia, actually, I kind of love everywhere I go because I meet nice people and we work hard.
In all the times, all the miles you've covered in travel, what have you learned about yourself or other people or society?
I think that people are much more alike than you think. And when you sit down and share a glass of wine with them, you're going to find you're even more alike.
Do you have travel tips, efficiency tips, anything related to travel and work that you think you could pass on to our audience?
I think some of the things that I use when I'm traveling all the time are the transit apps for the Paris Metro, the New York Metro, and in China. They're very useful, as well as Google Maps, so you know where you're going and you don't have to worry about signs being in a different language. You can use your phone, and having an international data plan that is unlimited is essential for me. I also find that living on a little bit different time zone is helpful to me. I live on the West Coast. I live on East Coast time for the most part, and that helps me with traveling because I do spend a fair amount of time going back and forth to the East Coast. When I go to Europe, it's less of an adjustment. So those are things that I use. TSA PreCheck, Global Entry, Nexus for Canada, all really helpful when getting through the airport quickly. I rarely check any kind of luggage, so I've become an extremely efficient packer.
So you mentioned the time zones. That's an interesting thing. If you're based in California, the West Coast of the U.S., but traveling a lot to the U.S. East Coast, the New York time zone. So does that mean you get up at 4 a.m. all the time?
Yeah, I do. I pretty much get up just a little bit before 4. I check my email because I'll still have people up in Asia and I'll have people up in Europe, so I can get things answered relatively quickly. And then I practice my French and then I go to the gym at 5.
So how do you feel like yourself when you're 8 or 9 time zones from home? How do you stay mentally sharp when you're on the road?
I have to exercise. I just absolutely have to exercise. I try to really keep running every morning, no matter what time zone that I'm in, and that helps just reset my routine. I never turn on the television when I'm in the hotel room. I don't watch the plane televisions because that's just going to keep you awake when you should be sleeping. And if I wake up after 2 hours of sleep and I know I've got to actually get up in 3 hours, I'm not going to turn on my phone and start working. I'm going to keep my eyes closed and focus on just relaxing, because as soon as you get up and you turn on an electronic device, you're awake. So at least you're resting if you can't sleep. And so I just kind of power through.
Yeah, that's great advice. Just because you're awake doesn't mean you're supposed to actually get up and start looking at your phone. That's really good.
And it's hard not to. And the other thing that I've learned is there's that wonderful do not disturb feature. And so it allows you to not have your phone ring. I have mine set, doesn't ring after 9 p.m. or buzz or anything until 7 a.m. Because not everyone knows that you're in another country. And so they think they're calling you at a reasonable hour. And having that do not disturb on your phone enables you not to get called in the middle of the night when you are finally getting some sleep.
So as we said, you've been a CEO for, I guess, now about 10 years. What have you learned since first taking the job?
Oh, gosh, so many things. I think the key is always to hire people who are smarter than you in what they do, and to really kind of continue to challenge them, because smart people like to be challenged and they like to have success. And I like to have success. So I think that's a lot of fun. I think that having a creative team and a diverse team is super important. And that brings more perspective to your management group.
So for someone out there who's an aspiring CEO, what advice would you give them?
Well, a lot of the same things. Love what you do. Work with people who know more than you do. Do the right thing always. If you make mistakes, own them. We all make mistakes, but own them, because other people might help you solve them a little bit better. Check your ego at the door. I think one of the things that I love about the people I work with at St. Supery is it's not about us. It's about the wine. It's about the company and our visitors here. And if we put them first, then we'll be successful.
This to me seems like it's been an excellent full-bodied discussion. but thank you so much, Emma.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil. It was a lot of fun.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the Association of International Certified Professional Accountants or any of its subsidiaries or affiliates. It is provided with the understanding that the association, its affiliates, and subsidiaries are not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The association, its subsidiaries, and affiliates make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to and assume no responsibility for the content or application of the material contained herein, and expressly disclaim all liability for such damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.